Welcome to Soundbites, a series about the food we eat. We're going to spend the next year examining the entire system of how food gets from the farm to your table, including the history, politics, health, and environmental concerns, and the economics of wholesome food. You're already familiar with some of the issues. Our neighborhoods have become food deserts with not a supermarket to be seen around us for miles. Our children are unhealthy with type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure showing up at younger and younger ages. Many of us die too young from preventable diseases. We believe it doesn't have to be this way. Over the coming year, we're going to share stories about our food. We'll explore how farms, both urban and rural, can feed and employ our people, how we can get fresh produce to our citizens, how we can take care of the environment, and how we can create a 21st century food system that is more just and healthier for each of us and our world. We believe it can be done. Please join us as we explore how we get there together. Where do you get your food? Do you have to drive, take a cab, or public transportation? Or can you walk? Is there a grocery store or farmer's market in your neighborhood? This week on the show, we're talking about the problem of food deserts in Baltimore, areas of the city where residents do not have easy access to stores that sell fresh, healthy, affordable food. Many have to rely on corner stores that stock heavily processed foods. Up first, we'll hear from Joy Smith, Executive Director of Operation Reach Out Southwest. Joyce is a longtime community activist who has dedicated her life to ensuring that her neighbors in Southwest Baltimore are educated about healthy food choices and have access to affordable, delicious, healthy options. Then Rebecca Messner, Assistant Editor of Urbanite Magazine, joins us to talk about the Urbanite Project, a search for the most creative solution to the problem of food deserts. Finally, our correspondent, Tom Horton, takes us inside the mind and motivations of that familiar Chesapeake creature, the jellyfish. Up first, here's our conversation with Joy Smith from Operation Reach Out Southwest. So here we are with Joy Smith. Joyce, glad you could see us today.
Glad to be in your presence.
So let's start with just talk a bit about how you came to become aware of issues around food in your life and neighborhood. What happened?
Okay, I was hired as the Oswald Project Director. Then I became the Executive Director of Operation Reach Out Southwest. It's a community coalition, and one of the issues we identify, six issues, and one of the issues we identify is health. And with this Oswald coalition, we did a plan, a community comprehensive plan, what issues needed to be addressed to make Southwest a better place to live. And like I said, health was one of them. Well, in 2005, and when we talked about health, we were focusing mostly on, at the time, Operation Reach Out Southwest came into play, which was the late 1990s, 98, is when our plan, community plan, was published. And the plan consists of six issue areas, but how we came about the plan, over 250 residents met for 15 months to identify the six issue areas, which I keep talking about, which is public safety, physical planning, health, education, youth and seniors, and housing.
Was this for the Center for Livable Futures?
No, the foundation for me was Center for Livable Futures, accelerating to the Center for Livable Futures. Like I talk about the health piece, because health, I started noticing the people in the neighborhood was obese. I started looking at, what was going on. Dr. Levice from Hopkins did a health disparity studies. And in that health disparity studies, it showed that we had some of the highest rates of chronic health diseases in Baltimore City. In the meantime, because Operation Reach Out Southwest was focusing on health, we did community gardens. How can we increase the access to healthy food? How, if someone wanted to eat healthy, what are the different avenues that people in urban communities could do? And what we did, we started a community gardening program. We didn't have a vacant lot. The first project we did was we built a pizza out of a child's swimming pool. At that time, we had an employee working with Bon Secours that connected me with Ann Palmer. And my connection with Ann Palmer was about talking about food desert. That was a term I had never heard before. The other term I've never heard before was food insecurity. So I'm like, oh, these are proper names for the issues that I became concerned about. Because once the health disparity studies was published, it showed strokes would increase heart disease and the other issues, social ills that, health ills that impact on life in urban communities. Well, Ann and I, after we developed and she started talking about doing a food survey, and we worked together to do the food assessment survey for Southwest Baltimore for the people in Operation Reach Out Southwest. What I liked about that survey, we didn't ask people to come to us. We went to where people were.
In their homes?
We went to senior buildings. We went to schools. We did invite people here. From that food assessment survey, the finding revealed that people do cook. People want to cook. But the biggest problem was having access to healthy foods. One of the things that jumped right out at us, that people in this neighborhood, the results from this or the finding from that food assessment survey showed that people travel to 29 different food outlets outside of this community just so they can have access. So that's how Ann and I, that's how my work with a Center for Livable Futures got started.
So how far they have to travel to do that?
Oh my gosh, some people go as far as Timonium. They take public transportation. I mean, everybody always talk about Baltimore and the hack system that we have where the folks staying out on the street.
Right.
The illegal cabs, they use those type of, they make arrangements. One thing about low-income people or poor people or people living in challenged communities, they have a underground way of getting their needs met. So a lot of them will take the bus. Then they make arrangements to either get a hack or a family member to pick them up and bring them back in. One of the things being a native Baltimorean, what I realized, what we have gotten away from, when I was growing up, if people had a plot of dirt, they worked it into soil and they grew stuff. Now we have two or three generations who no longer cook. So, like I said, working with the Center for Livable Futures, I learned the different terms or the research terms like food insecurities or, you know, what is a food desert and, you know, working on strategies that really help people see that you can eat healthier. And one of the things I always say to people growing up, again, in Baltimore, when we were poor, we didn't know we were poor. You know, the language of the food system has changed a great deal. Excuse me. I grew up, we ate beans. And now, since I'm involved with foods, beans are considered the poor man meat. So to get people who are not poor to consume more beans, they changed the names to legumes. And then when I first saw the word legumes, I'm like, what's legumes? And said it all wrong. So, you know, there were diets that, there were eating habits that low-income people had. We ate soup, be it black or white. You ate beans all year round. You ate soup all year round. And it's so funny, people now say, oh, you need to eat more beans.
Right, not the healthy thing to do,
It's
right?
The healthy thing to do. Oh, eat soup and have more broth. Well, we always had broth because that's how you fill up. So, but I also learned that, okay, if I know this at my age, which I'm rather mature, something happened in this, in our country. And I feel what happened, like McDonald's came about. They told us you deserve a break today. Burger King came into existence. They say, have it your way. And what happened, we stopped having the family dinners. We started letting everybody else cook for us because that was the posh thing to do. You know, after church, you all used to go to a relative house and eat out the mixed mac dishes. But now you can go to the local restaurants because everybody drives and no one is cooking. You know, we have two or three generations of young people. Now, I used to say young mothers, but guys can cook because my son can cook. But you have people that can't cook. You know, they want to eat healthy, but the only way they know how to cook is that it come out of a box or you put it in water or you put it in the oven. The skills to learn how to cook from scratch was a dying art. But back to the food assessment survey, it showed that people in Southwest, a lot of people in Southwest still cook their own meals. But where they have to go to get the food to cook become another issue. And understanding that everything is about quick, fast, and a hurry. The being involved with a Center for Livable Futures. We're now working on, we're working at the supermarket project that we're working with the supermarket that provide food to Southwest Baltimore Food Depot, and talking to the owners and saying, this is what we need to have. When we first started those conversations, people assumed that low-income and challenged people don't want to eat healthy. But again, it's having access to the healthy things. Like the corner stores in this area, the food assessment survey revealed that most store owners only carry 2% milk or whole milk. For folks who need to drink 1% or skim milk, especially older individuals, you have to, a lot of times, go outside of your community. I've had conversations with folks, both providers, service providers, that says, well, they won't eat fresh fruit because they don't want that person behind the plexiglass picking their fruit. They want to pick their own stuff. They want their hands to go on it. So you look at a lot of things that has happened, and what I've, again, like I said, what I've learned from a Center for Livable Futures, there are policy issues. We have, it's a lot of carryouts in this neighborhood. None of them really offer a salad. You have to get the fried wings, the french fries, and by Ronald Reagan standards, the only vegetable they get is ketchup. So, you know, working with a Center for Livable Futures pointed out that there are some policy issues. There are barriers beyond the low-income community folks' control. One of the things for me, folks who are getting food stamps, there was a big roar about a few months ago accepting them at fast food carryouts. That's part of the health issues. You know, I'm not saying people should not eat fast food. But let's take that same money that we're going to give to the fast food industry and do some cooking lessons. If folks getting food stamps, let's see if they give them a basic worksheet or allow them to come in. And we're not doing this now, to learn how to take a little bit. And it doesn't have to be costly. If you want to go to Whole Foods, no, low-income people, it is hard to go to Whole Foods. It is hard to go to Whole Foods. But if you show folks how to do it, basically go back to the way life was in Baltimore in the 50s and the 60s, when everything didn't come out of a can, when the only time you saw a fast food carryout place was when you was on the highway. Go back to more family structured eating. People say, oh, everybody's working. Well, you know, let's have family time. Let's cook dinner. One of the things I shared with a young mother, I'm like, give your kid a piece of raw sweet potato. They would be so happy with the sweet potato that you'd be able to cook all the dinner for 2 days. I'm not saying people should cook every day. I just think they should reduce the number of days that they eat food that's not prepared by their hands or a relative, or you don't know where that's coming from.
One of the things you said so much, Joyce. One of the things you said was that people want to eat healthy. And there's no access to healthy food. Mm-hmm. I think that's important to kind of wrestle with the men. I mean, you, the idea that what it means to live in a food desert, and what is a food desert to you? Because you thought about it before the word, but now we have this word food desert.
Food desert is a community or an area where people don't have access to proper nutrition. That's, I think the radius is a half mile outside or a mile outside of where they reside. And a lot of, in West Baltimore and Southwest Baltimore, this is clearly a food desert because the only supermarket that we have close and close proximity to where we are now in Southwest Baltimore is the Food Depot.
Where's that?
It's down at West Side Shopping.
That's where I thought
It took over the space that the Superfresh was in.
Okay.
The Superfresh. And then a lot of people, and I probably get banged up for this, when Safeway moved from Mount Clair Shopping Center, they said, oh, how could they leave? Well, the staff and the manager that was at that Safeway wasn't a very friendly Safeway store. So if people are not treated right, they're not going to support. So that no one ever talks about that. What is the problem? Why is it a problem? We have done different little things here. I work out of the Barnesville Community Works Building that's 26 North Fulton Avenue. We started a community garden. But we started the community gardening, not just for the health issues, but as a intergenerational project. Because for me, being a community leader and advocate, the art of growing your own food, or the practice of growing your own food, was a dying art in this neighborhood. When we started the community gardens, it seemed like more of the older people came out. They taught us the shortcuts. I'm a city girl by birthright. I took the master gardener's training. I now have a garden in my backyard. I live about four blocks from where I work. I live right in the heart of the hood or whatever, but folks, my neighbors know that I grow my own vegetables. I do composting. It was just so funny when I started. People were like, oh, the rats. And I'm like, do you know where your food come from? So it needs to really be like an educational project, a process, because folks are really what I've learned, that people are not aware of what happened to our foods. In 2008, I applied and became an Open Society Institute Fellow. I worked on a project, Health and Nutrition Awareness, in Southwest Baltimore, because there is a lack of awareness. You know, the stores all moved out. When I was a kid, you had, which was mostly Jewish guys, you had the Jewish store owner. You look at Highlands Market. They had guys that sold more produce. Now you go down to Highlands Market, you have more eateries and one produce stand. You know, you have the meat stands. So you look at what happened in the city. And when I talk about what happened with the city, the guys, we used to have the Arabs. The policy or the laws in the city, we don't have the Arabs like we used to.
Men on the
had the horse and
horse carts, and they sold fresh produce. And
they had horse carts. They had trucks. It was a white guy that set up on Lombard Street. When I first moved in this neighborhood 23 years ago, he set up on Lombard. I think it was Lombard and Poppleton, or one of those, or Arlington. He sold fresh produce out of that every Saturday. You know, he had the traffic stopping on Lombard Street. What happened, the wholesale house that the Arabs and the folks who sold produce moved to Jessup. So, again, that was an access that was just severed. That was a means of, really, for me as a kid, I was about 10 before I actually went to Highlands Market. The Arabs were the providers of the produce. We don't have that anymore. So you look at what happened and or what has happened with the laws and the policy issues within this city, everything got pushed out. And so you either have to have a car, you have to have transportation. Then the other thing that has happened, we lost a lot of our old-time folks who were entrepreneurs that sold produce. So now I'm working with a Center for Livable Futures, looking at different strategies. You know, they paid for a community supportive agriculture program for us. Now, most people in this community, or most folks who know how CSAs work, that the income level here, you have to pay up front. But and working with a Center for Livable Futures, we were able to get the 10 shares delivered. And we set it up. I set it up like a farmer's market, an urban farmer's market. I priced each item like $2.50, and people will come in, and people, but having that CSA and working with a Center for Livable Futures, people were able to see dinosaur kale. We just didn't see the regular kale. We saw yellow tomatoes. We saw golden cauliflower. My one gentleman that lives on Fulton Avenue, he would walk by me every week. He would never buy anything. He bought a watermelon. He came back the next day, the next week, and he said how sweet that watermelon was. It tastes different. It looked different. So meeting people and coming up with strategies, I feel my relationship with the Center for Livable Futures have allowed low-income communities or the communities that I represent to have a voice and saying, no, that's not true. We don't want to always eat fried chicken. You know, we want to taste fresh produce. You know, you give a kid an apple, but how do we have access? You know, it's like pointing out that you're not doing this right, but you're not helping me do it better. And because the policy issues need to change in this community, the health department published a their findings that people in this community live 20 years less than folks in more, much better income areas.
Mm-hmm. More affluent communities.
More affluent communities. But they also live in better because they have the means to survive, to make the changes. A lot of times, you know, we have people in here, we have the highest number of chronic health diseases. Another example I would like to give you. Folks here, we have a lot of people who are diabetics. They go to the doctors. The doctor may send them to the nutritionist or the dietitian, and they give them a sheet of paper where these are the foods that you have to eat. What I have learned from my OSI fellowship is you can give them the sheet of paper. They know what it is, but how to maneuver in a market, how to break those family practices. You know, folks in this neighborhood says, oh, I'm diabetic because my mother was diabetic. No, you still have the same lifestyle. People need to learn how to make the lifestyle changes. And that's what my work with working with the Center for Livable Futures have truly allowed me to sit down. When I sit with a lot of the young professionals, it's so enlightening. Let me say so enlightening. They have all the answers. But they're the answers that you have come up with. What about the voice of the person in this community that know they want to do something, but how can you help me? You know, having the, when we did the food assessment survey, it showed that people cook. But it also showed that people have a hard time having access. There's certain herbs that people may want to use that they don't sell them in this neighborhood. If it doesn't sell, that supermarket is not going to stock it. So, you know, that's just like now working with Food Depot. It's a family that interact with us that did the survey, a Center for Livable Futures. They did, we did a survey, focus groups, and we had surveys. It was really the awareness about the Food Depot store that serves us. The community is well aware. But folks don't generally hear that. You know, it's like it was a couple, they wanted to get dream rice milk or some type of soy milk. They didn't carry it. But because a Center for Livable Futures have initiated this relationship with the Food Depot people, now we can go and get soy milk. Well, at first they said, people didn't sell that. You know, people didn't buy that. So he didn't bother to stock it. And when I say educating, you have to meet people where they are. I had a conversation with a young lady, and I was talking about eating wheat bread. And she said, well, they can't afford wheat bread. I says, you either pay for it on the front end or you pay for it on the back end. You need two slices of white bread because it's empty calories. It's nothing in it. You eat one slice of good wheat bread. And if you have a hard time buying wheat bread, go over to the H&S Bakery over on Fleet Street. You buy one loaf and you get the Everloaf free. And you can freese it. I mean, my daughter said, Ma, people are not going to take time to do that. I said, yes, they will once they see the benefit. Right now, we're not showing them a benefit because the other avenues, like the McDonald's and the established folks, they have money. They have a big budget to convince us. And people do not believe me, Mr. Steiner, when I say they pay therapists to understand our behavior on how to brainwash us to go buy this stuff. I mean, they have therapists and psychologists. They have a big budget to snow you to think you need to do these things. Right. And that's what has happened, you know. But for me, I'm like, I may be a lone voice, but there are people who are listening, you know.
They want you to buy that Big Mac.
They want you to buy that Big Mac. They want you to buy the fries, you know.
Right.
So
I wonder what you think. You said, again, so much. I was thinking about all the things you said. If you can envision what would transform neighborhoods like here in Southwest, what would that be? I was thinking, you talked about Harlem Market. Mm-hmm. And I remember all the markets where all the produce used to be all over the city. Right?
Lafayette outside Market, in the cold.
Right? And here in Harlem Market. And all over the place. Broadway Market, they all had, that's where working people went to buy their food.
Yeah.
And the Arabers were part of the delivery system of food neighborhoods. So I wonder what you think is, if you can envision a future to change things, what do you think this place should look like instead?
I think some of the, just where we have a lot of green space, I think it should be projects and activities where we can show and teach people how to grow. Where did food come from? Because a lot of people don't know where their food's coming from. I feel it should be an educational component around family education. Because one of the things in the city, everybody wants to teach the children. And I'm not against teaching children. But you need to also teach the decision maker or whomever is running the household. Because that's where the changes starts as well. So we want to give the kids, empower these kids with all of this information and all of this knowledge. But on the back end, they are not able to make the change. They're able to influence the changes within the household. But I feel when we start, we go back to basics and doing things as a family. I think for me with this city, that's a big question. Because it starts at different levels. Food access, health and awareness. It needs to be a component within this that teaches people that your diet will reflect your health outcome pretty much. I think we have a lot of high blood pressure and diabetes because a lot of people have eaten a lot of foods that contribute to that, but also that exercise need to be a part of what needs to happen because when you live a lifestyle where all you just eating and sitting on the couch, those calories are going to go someplace. One of the things that I'm concerned about now is parents don't put their children outside. Kids don't go outside to play anymore. So that whole physical burning off the excess energy. So if you're not out burning it off, you're going to sit in the house and you're going to consume. So, you know, we have these kids. We had a young lady. I had encountered a young lady who had a five-year-old that was diagnosed with high blood pressure. So if he's five with high blood pressure, by the time he gets 12, he will be a true diabetic. If some changes don't take place, you know. I think eating the foods that, you know, we don't like to chew. Americans want everything soft. I think understanding that we should not be cooking the life out of our produce or the life out of our vegetables. What I would do, I would have a growing program. I would get with one of my desires is to get with these institutions, especially these health institutions, to have folks that have diabetes and sit down and do house visits, you know, because a lot of times we invite people in. What I've learned in doing the 23 years I've been doing community work, you go to the people, they're more receptive, they really feel that you care about them. People don't want to tell what they're doing wrong. I think changing up our language, there's some images that really gets people feeling uncomfortable. They don't want to share a lot. So for me, it's working with all of these people that are now doing things and doing an in-depth assessment on how can we make it better. Because I don't want to say that it's not working, but we need to work on it better because food and at the rate in which we're doing things in this country, food access, food insecurities, and food deserts, they're going to be on the rise. But how can we go back to establishing the better outcomes? Because for me, it was a personal change because medication, you know, I have what is called, what I feel is genetic high blood pressure. My grandmother died from a stroke, so for me, it's like changing my diet, eating healthy, cut out the sodas. We just focus so much on, in America, we reward and celebrate around food that tastes good, not food that's good for you. So now when I'm invited to the family functions, everybody knows she's going to bring something healthy. But what really makes my day is when I do bring whatever is healthy, that people partake in it and try to change. So I've seen changes within my own family. I've seen changes in this community. But people need more assistance in helping making the change.
You're listening to Soundbites on Delmarva, and we'll be right back with more from Joy Smith. Welcome back to Soundbites on Delmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. This week, we're talking about food deserts, areas of Baltimore City where residents do not have access to fresh, healthy food. Here's more from Joy Smith, Executive Director of Operation Reach Out Southwest.
So how does how do people respond to your garden? Have other people started gardens, watching your garden?
Oh, we have a lot of gardeners in this area. I mean, up the street, we have the Johnsons who don't have a backyard, who have a cement backyard, so they have gardens on, you know, they grow stuff on the front. There are a lot of things. Our former delegate, Ruth Coates, she had a big plot of land that she did gardening in, you know what I mean? There are a lot of folks around that's still gardening. I remember a couple of years ago, I was at Hopkins doing a workshop, and a little fella came over. He says, "Oh, Miss Smith, I really enjoyed your talking." He said, "I'm going to go back to the low-income neighborhood, and I'm going to teach the people how to garden." And I looked at the young man. I'm like, "Sweetie, you're going to go back to the low-income neighborhoods and get your feelings hurt." Because most people like me, we came from sharecropping. So what you want, if you want to be successful, you can go back to the low-income communities and work with the younger people and show them how their foreparents did it. So that's the rate, that's the how you have to go back, because it's nothing new. We just have to reconnect with it, and we have to get folks to say, this is where you have control of what you're eating. You know, when I decided to do composting, my one neighbor, she's like, "Well, I'm going to use Miracle-Gro. I'm like, "Okay, you can use, I don't want to use Miracle-Gro." But that same neighbor, she had really stepped out. She bought herself a compost bin. In fact, both of them had bought a compost bin. I just still do composting in a trash can, you know. So with some holes, I'm not buying a bin. That's just to get more money, you know. My foreparents didn't buy a compost bin. They did a pile with a trash can. So that's what I did. And my neighbor who, she basically grew flowers, she came to me and she said, "I need you to show me how to do that composting stuff, because we got our plants. We shop the same place down under the bridge." She said, "But yours just looks so much healthier." And I feel that's something, for me being the age I am, I didn't know about composting until I took the master gardening class. But once I took it, I'm like, "Oh, that's what my neighbor that used to live next door to me had this plastic container that he would throw everything in. And he would let it go, but he always said his go back the nature pot." So I just think we've gotten away. We just became so convinced in this country that we need everything quick, fast, and in a hurry. And since I've only lived in America, I can only talk about America. I don't want anybody to say this is what they're doing. This, I'm speaking from where I've started doing a lot of things.
So you mentioned food insecurity, food deserts. How does food insecurity manifest itself here where you live?
Well, food insecurities, you can buy bread here, and you can buy wheat bread, but it's hard to buy 100% whole grain bread.
Right, the wheat bread you buy here is this brownish white bread.
It's enriched.
It's enriched, right?
It's enriched, and that's one of the things I tell people. I'm like, you don't want to buy bread where the first word is enriched. You want to buy bread that says whole grain. And that's where the education piece come in. And they say, "Well, what's the difference?" I'm like, it has been stripped down. I did a workshop. And like I said, working with a Center for Livable Futures just allowed me to reach a larger audience of people who are in the know but need to modify. I'm already connected to an audience of folks that don't know. But when we're out there gardening, you know, folks really do want to learn. And it's how you catch people. One of the people always say, "Well, just how you get them to talk? How you get them to share?" I'm like, my opening line, like, "Do you know anybody that's diabetic?" Most folks here gonna know something. "Do you think it comes from the, how do you think they got to be diabetics? Or how did they come down with the disease?" I'm like, "Do you think their diet have anything to do with it?" And you just start asking folks questions and, you know, engage in a dialogue. Like, I was at the corner store one day, and a young lady asked the guy, she said, "Well, can you give me one of those cherry juices?" And I had gotten my order, and I was on my way out, and I was just in a jokingly way. I'm like, "How you know that juice is cherry and not just red?" And I, you know, proceeded to walk down the street, and she came behind me like, "Wait a minute, miss, I need you to tell me more about that." I'm like, "Go and read the label." I said, "You read the label." I say, a lot of times they want you to read the nutrition content, but either start with the nutrition content or you start with the ingredients and you see what's in it. And, you know, even with bread, so that's a part of the food insecurity piece. You have access, but it's not a good access, you know, or people don't want to come. I do a farmer's market as well, and it's like that's to help address the issues. But a lot of farmers don't want to come in the area where their food deserts. You know, they want to establish neighborhood. So now my two farmers, and for next year I have a third farmer coming. But when I did the farmer's market in 2011, just last year, I was running at one point in time, I was running a one-farmer farmer's market. And, you know, folks would come out. But to me, it had to be done because, and I'm glad Mr. Green, Mr. Mortimer from Green's Farm hung in there with, you know, with us doing the farmer's market. Because how you get people out, there's so many, you know, like, modalities to get people that we need to work on. Our farmer's market became successful when another group I was working with sent out letters to the Department of Social Services, and they found out that they could use their independent card. But on top of that, there were incentives that were sponsored, that was promoted for some farmers market. And the Center for Livable Futures, you got an additional $5 if you completed a survey to talk about it. So, you know, really getting people up. Our farmers market ended on November the 19th. And we ran out of bonus bucks money, but it was able to, people didn't know we were there. So in Baltimore, I think you have the health department. Everybody wants to be the big winner or the individual big winner. I think we all could be big winners when we partner together. I feel I'm a big winner because I partnered with a Center for Livable Futures, and I was able to learn not just from the residential aspect of it, but from the policy issues, from the commercial issues, and how these issues are regional issues. You know, I can talk from an urban perspective, but if you go out to some of our rural areas, they have the same issues because it's a food desert, and having access to healthy foods. And how do you get people to kind of change it? Again, you're looking at the two or three generations that don't cook. You know, we all can remember that grandmother or that person that could make foods. But now everything comes out of a box. You know, we're up against the mighty media and the Monsantos and the Crafts. Even though they all, you know, changing their image and they're trying to do better. But, you know, you just have to stop buying stuff that was grown in out of the country. You know, the other little joke I always tell about eating healthy and eating different. We went on vacation one year, and my daughter gave me the blues because I wanted to take a tomato out of my garden. And she said, well, Mom, they sell tomatoes down in South, because we went to Myrtle Beach, in South Carolina. I'm like, yeah, but I want to bring my own. So I bought my own, and she bought one from one of those stores in South Carolina, and we happened to use it at the same time. She was able to see. She said, well, Ma, why your tomato is much redder than mine? I said, because mine ripened on a vine and yours ripened on a truck with gases. That's what's happening with our food system. And she says, really? I'm like, really? I mean, it's right there. So, you know, they're the little tricks to get people to really understand. We can eat out of season. Americans want to eat out of season. We need to go back to basics. You know, my grandmother cooked on Sunday. My grandmother cooked on Wednesday. And on Saturday, we had pork and beans, some other quick meal that she put together, maybe some soup because she was famous for making soups. But, you know, now we're like, oh, I don't want to cook. Just hop in the car and we can go someplace else to eat. You know, but cooking is fun. You know, it's a good thing. And I think the change came in the 50s and the 60s where, you know, everybody wanted a TV dinner. Right. Everybody wanted canned corn, you know, so that's the change. And no, you know, back then, and there were other times, but I remember when, you know, we're like, can we get a TV dinner? I'm like, no, I'm a cook. I'm not saying that eating canned vegetables are bad for you, but if you have to eat canned vegetables, rinse the juice off and start over. You know, if you're going to, you know, a lot of people like to cook with meat, you know, a lot of low income people like to eat meat. You know, try using garlic. Garlic and lemon juice is something, I mean, I don't even buy Kraft salad dressing anymore. I make my own. It's lemon juice and olive oil or balsamic vinegar. Learning how to eat the things that you already have. or use the things that you already have, and just say, I'm going to try something different. You know, so I just think we need to go back to research and beginning to believe that everybody is a partner.
That was Joy Smith, Executive Director of Operation Reach Out Southwest. Up next, here's Rebecca Messner, Assistant Editor of Urbanite Magazine. I asked her to explain a little bit about the upcoming Urbanite Project, which seeks to find creative solutions to the problem of food deserts in Baltimore.
The Urbanite Project has been around in some form since 2007. But back then, it started as a way for us to put together people who normally would not interact and would not work together. So we would put together something like an architect in the city and a ballerina and tell them to collaborate on a project.
Right. We covered a lot of those in the list.
Yeah. And then so last year, the concept of Urbanite Project sort of changed, and we opened it up to the public, and the idea was to make it something where these, you know, big ideas could actually be implemented. So Urbanite Project last year was the Open City Challenge, and it had to do with the Red Line, which is the east-west train line that has yet to be built, that's going to run from Security Square through the Inner Harbor, Fells Point, and Canton out to Hopkins Bayview Medical Campus. And it's sort of a, you know, it's a controversial issue. People feel very strongly either way about it. So, and construction is supposed to take up to 5 years. So mm-hmm. we asked the public to sort of find a way to use this construction time as a way to make positive change in the city. So we sent out a request for proposals and got a bunch of proposals, and they came from all over the world, and we offered up $10,000 in prize money, and we awarded the prize this October of 2011. And yeah. So Urbanite Project 2012 is the same sort of idea. We're asking the public for their ideas, and the issue this year is healthy food and improving access to healthy food throughout Baltimore City.
So what do you see as the issues you're going to cover and how you're going to cover them?
Well, we're focusing on the sort of state of healthy food in Baltimore, and the state, you know, sort of Baltimore's health. Like 2/3 of the city's adults and 40% of high school students are either overweight and obese. And there's major disparities between blacks and whites, and people who have college degrees and don't have college degrees, and people who make, you know, more or less than $25,000 a year. And there are these things called food deserts in the city. And the Baltimore City Health Department and the center, Johns Hopkins School of Public Health's Center for
a Livable Future,
put out just a new definition of food deserts. And they're launching it in March, so that's pretty exciting. And it's fortuitous that our Urbanite Project launches in March as well. And so these new criteria are for food deserts are there's there are neighborhoods where they're more than a quarter mile away from a supermarket, where the median household income is at or below 185% of the federal poverty level, and where 40% of households have no vehicle available, and the average healthy food availability index for nearby supermarkets is low. So meaning there may be corner stores and supermarkets, but they don't have healthy food there.
Right.
So we figure that these food deserts, which make up a sizable portion of Baltimore City, are a good place to start. A good place to ask for the public's ideas on how to increase access to healthy food, to affordable healthy food in these areas.
And so what is the way you're going to approach that? I mean, are you going to approach it through stories that you're going to have people write? Are you going to approach it by just having people write in with ideas?
Well,
how do you intend to do this?
Yeah, we're going to sort of come at it the same way that we came at it last year. So last year we asked for people's ideas in the form of basically like foam core poster boards. And they have a certain size limit, and you know, we ask for like 500 words on each of these boards. But above, you know, beyond that, we're keeping it very open. So people can submit design proposals. They can submit, you know, lists and pictures, and they can, you know, plan their ideas visually or, you know, through words. But it's basically whatever you can fit on this foam core poster board is fair game. And then so once we receive these proposals, which are due May 31st, we're going to have an exhibition, traveling exhibition, where we put them in different spots around the city. We're trying to find varied spots so that, you know, the highest number of people are able to see these proposals. And then the public will vote on them, and then we'll bring a jury in to pick the winners.
And so since you're tackling the issue of food and food deserts and the issue of food in Baltimore, I mean, how are you going to do that in the magazine itself? What are you going to be doing other than
the— Yeah, that's a good question. We're going to be devoting a fair amount of editorial coverage to the issue of food deserts. And the idea is so that we can, you know, the articles will be directed towards people who are interested in entering these contests. So in the April issue, we're planning on talking to a family or more than one family who lives in a food desert and asking them, you know, what sort of challenges they face when they're, you know, trying to get food for their family and what they would like to see changed, what they would like to see, you know, different for their family and for their community. You know, so sort of each month we'll have an article that's based on the topic of healthy food and food deserts. And we'll talk about, you know, other things that are happening in Baltimore that other groups and organizations are doing, because there's a tremendous amount of work that's already being done in this area. You know, we're with the Center for Livable Future, and the Baltimore City Health Department's virtual supermarkets, which they have in the Enoch Pratt Library. And there's an OSI fellow that's working on improving access to healthy food, you know, in addition to the numerous sort of urban garden movements like Real Food Farms. So it's just sort of calling attention to the things that are already happening in Baltimore City. We're hoping we'll – and in Baltimore City and in other cities, we're hoping we'll inspire, you know, new creative ideas. And one of the things about Urbanite Project in general, you know, even when it back when it started in 2007, is we really want, you know, the most creative ideas possible. So especially last year with the Red Line Project, we made it clear that, you know, there is always the possibility of being able to implement these ideas at a certain point. So we want always there to be the possibility of the ideas to come to fruition, yeah, to actually have an impact on the city. But that shouldn't limit, you know, the proposals. We want the most creative ideas possible. So things like cost of implementation and practicality should, I think, be somewhere in people's minds, but it shouldn't limit the creativity of the ideas. We're offering up $12,000 in prize money, which will be distributed among a first prize winner, two runners-up, and then a People's Choice Award, which will be awarded to the person that gets the most public votes. We're going to have all these all the proposals, when they come in, we're going to put them up on a website so the public can either vote in person at our traveling exhibition or on our website. And the prize money comes to us from our partners, who are the Baltimore City Health Department, the Maryland Department of Agriculture, Stratford University, and United Way of Central Maryland. And then our sponsors are American Communities Trust, Enoch Pratt Free Library, the Lyric Opera House, the Mark Steiner Show, Richardson Farms, and Zia's Catering. So if anybody has any questions about Urbanite Project, anyone wants to know more, is thinking of entering, we strongly encourage you to come to a question and answer session on March 6th at the Lyric Opera House from 5 to 6 p.m. And we will be there, Urbanite will be there, and also representatives from our institutional partners will be there to answer any questions you may have. So hope to see you there.
That was Rebecca Messner, assistant editor of Urbanite magazine. For more information, urbaniteproject.com. Up next, here's correspondent Tom Horton with a stinging critique of humanity from the perspective of a Chesapeake Bay jellyfish.
Hello, I'm Tom Horton for On Delmarva, pondering perhaps the greatest question of our age. Why must an otherwise perfectly good Chesapeake Bay fill up with jellyfish every summer as the weather warms? No body of water on the planet is more productive of these stinging sea nettles. Maryland's legislature was working to eradicate them as early as the 1930s, with no success whatsoever. In 1970, the U.S. Congress sent the Jellyfish Control Act to President Nixon for his signature, which produced impressive research but no solution. Now, personally, I've always thanked the jellyfish, along with greenhead flies and mosquitoes, for keeping Delmarva less heavily settled and touristed than it might have been. But I still often wonder, usually after a painful, nettlesome encounter, why the bay needs jellyfish. And recently, in a dream, the answer was revealed. Two jellyfish appeared, deep in conversation, opalescent bell shapes pulsing and tentacles undulating sensuously as they spoke back and forth. And this is what they said. Doggone nuisances? Does anyone even know where they come from? Now, no one knows for sure, but every summer, just about the time the weather's getting great for swimming, here they come out of nowhere, great grotesque thrashing hunks of raw meat jumping off boats, piers, and river banks. Gets so by July it's almost impossible for a nettle to avoid touching one. Aren't they good to eat? Nap, too big to paralyze. Total waste of your poison. But surely anything that numerous must have some role in the greater scheme of things. Maybe not directly useful to us nettles, but at least important to the bay ecosystem. You would think so. They are obviously estuarine-dependent organisms. Worldwide, 7 of their 10 biggest cities are located on estuaries like Chesapeake Bay. But the connection isn't obvious. All they seem to do is take crabs, take oysters, take rockfish, take. All they put back is their sewage and chemicals and trash. Really, all the evidence is that the bay could exist just fine without humans. Well, what's known about their life cycle? Where do they go in the fall? How do they survive cold weather? Most of them seem to retreat in September up two major tributaries, the Potomac and the Patapsco, which we surmise may have some unique habitats essential to their spawning and overwintering. We know they're a tough, resilient species. Remember Tropical Storm Agnes back in 72? How all that fresh water knocked the nettle population back for years? Well, by August of that same year, humans were back in the bay like nothing had happened. I've heard they seem to be on the increase. Some say if it keeps up, there may soon be no room left for nettles. I'm not so sure of that. If the bay hadn't been made for us jellyfish, would we have prospered so well here? I can't believe we're not a part of some grander design of nature that may or may not include humans. Look at it this way. We Salinarates have been around close to a quarter billion years, a real evolutionary success story. Human existence has been less than 1% of that time, certainly not long enough to judge their staying power. Some of our scientists think their only real role is to unearth all nature's buried carbon, get it back into circulation. And by all accounts, they've about finished that job. Already, we nettles are benefiting from longer, hotter summers, you know. So what you see in the last couple centuries may amount to just a fluke, like a temporary outbreak of flu or some virus. Rough while it lasts, but over as quick as it came. Poof.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break.